KUTX 98.9. I'm Jody Denberg, live in Studio 1A, and this is truly a privilege, an honor, and a joy to welcome Bruce Cockburn to KUTX. He has two shows this Friday, that would be tonight, at the One World Theater. Canadian Music Hall of Fame member, man who just received a Lifetime Achievement Award from SOCAN, which is this organization of composers and authors and publishers in Canada, a five-time honorary doctorate. Bruce, I could go on and on. Does it sound like I'm speaking of someone else in a way?
Oh, no, no, no. I own all of it. Yeah.
Very good.
Well, it sounds like another life, though, in a way. I mean, all that stuff is so... It's not meaningless at all, but it's sort of beside the point in a way. And it's interesting. It gets like a parallel universe, you know, that kind of recognition that has only partly to do with the music and has partly to do with longevity and, you know, just constantly showing up and having a good manager and stuff like that, you know, so.
Well, but without the body of work, these things don't happen.
I guess you have to have something for people to refer back to. That's for sure.
I was trying to remember your first record. Are we talking your first solo record anyway? Would be about what, 1970?
Yeah, it was recorded at the end of 69. It came out in 70.
So we're talking about 40 plus years of great music and three dozen albums. And Bruce Cockburn has his latest album goes back a couple years, Small Source of Comfort. And we'll talk about that. I was curious where you're living now, because I always hear you referred to as Canada's Bruce Cockburn, but that's not the case right now.
Well, actually, yeah, as of pretty recently, I've had an American girlfriend for many years now. Like, we've been together about 9 years. We're now married as of not quite a year ago, and we have a little baby. And she has a nice job with the government in San Francisco. So I live in San Francisco now. if you'd asked me 5 years ago if I, A, would be having a baby and B, living in San Francisco, I would have said, no, I don't think so. I don't see that coming. But there it is, you know, so.
Well, I'm going to slightly adjust my intro and we'll have a song. Please welcome new Papa and San Francisco's Bruce Cockburn to the KUTX airwaves. What would you like to start with?
Well, actually, a song about an American city, but it's not San Francisco. This is actually one that was born in New Orleans, in the pre-Katrina New Orleans, as anybody who knows the city will recognize a couple of references. It's called When You Give It Away. Slid out of my dreams like a baby out of the nurse's hands onto the hard floor of day. I'd been wearing OJ's gloves and I couldn't get them off. It was too early, but I couldn't sleep. Showered and dressed and stepped out into the heat. The parrot things on the porch next door announced my arrival on Charters Street with their finest rendition of Squealing Brakes. And down in Caldy's Cafe, the newspaper headlines promised new revelations about Prince Charles's Amex account. A morose youth in old-time Austrian drag stared past his mustache at the floor. And last night's punks and fetish kids, all tattoos and metal bits. And in the other corner, wearing the white trunks, today's tourists already sweating. Deep in the city of the saints and fools, pearls before pigs and dung become jewels. I sit down with tigers, I sit down with lambs. None of them know who exactly I am.
I've got this thing in my heart I must give you today. It only lives when you give it away. Languid mandala of the ceiling fan teases the air like a slow stroking hand. Study the faces, study the cards. Study the shadow creeping over the yard. I've got this thing in my heart I must give you today. It only lives when you give it away. Trouble with the nations, trouble with relations. Where are you gonna go for some illumination? Too much to carry, too much to let go. Time goes fast, learning goes slow. But I've got this thing in my heart I must give you today. It only lives when you give it away. I've got this thing in my heart I must give you today. It only lives when you give it away. Give it away.
Bruce Coburn, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Live in Studio 1A on KUTX, When You Give It Away. Breakfast in New Orleans, Dinner in Timbuktu, was that the record?
I think so. Yeah, it would have to be because it's got New Orleans in it.
That's right. Yeah. You're playing solo at the One World Theater, and when you've released more than 36 records, how do you decide what you're going to play for your playlist?
Well, there's always a degree of emphasis on whatever's most recent, because it is most recent, and I guess when you're doing a tour immediately on the release of an album, you want to emphasize that stuff because you want people to know there is an album and that they should check it out. But over time, it becomes less important to see it from that angle, and it just becomes the songs that are the freshest for me and the most interesting to do. But in addition to stuff from a Small Source of Comfort, there'll be a cross-section of or whatever happened to be the current album, there'd be a cross-section of older material from various eras and points along the way. And that mix changes slightly from night to night and certainly from tour to tour. Old things that have disappeared off the radar suddenly pop back on, or I'll think of a new way of approaching a song that is maybe too familiar and is a little boring to do, and it comes back, that kind of thing.
You have more flexibility, obviously, not having a band with you tonight.
Yes, although I'm not sure I'm the greatest one at exercising that flexibility, because I tend to settle into a routine. If I find a show that works, I tend to keep it from night to night with variations. So that it'll, you know, someone who sees two consecutive nights will get a few different songs, but it'll be a similar show. It's partly that's based on what kind of guitars I decide to take, and therefore, you know, that'll kind of steer the mix of songs a bit.
The most recent record is a couple years back now, Small Source of Comfort. So you're on the road, but you're not necessarily promoting a new record. I think I read that you're writing a book. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm allegedly writing a book, and well, I kind of am now. I'm about 2 years behind on the deadline for my first draft, but I understand from talking to actual writers that that's kind of normal, and the publishing world is used to that. But anyway, they're tolerant of me, and it's going to be done. That first draft will be done by the end of July now. And it's a memoir. I mean, it's currently fashionable for everyone in the music world or any other world, I guess, to write memoirs. And but this was interesting because the publisher specifically requested a spiritual memoir. And I'm not sure what that means, and they were unable to articulate exactly what they meant by that. But it puts an interesting twist to it. And it has given me some trouble because, I mean, I have a great interest in the spiritual world and in my relationship with the divine. But most of what I have to say about that is in the songs already and doesn't merit a book. So to take that kind of stuff and put it in the context of the experience of a life is both interesting and challenging, and is gradually coming together and starting to work. But we'll see if anybody else finds it interesting.
I think people who are immersed in your music certainly will. I always noticed over the years on your albums, you would notate a song as to when and where it was written. Mm-hmm. So does that connote that you have kept diaries over the years and things like that?
No, that's about it.
Oh.
I have notebooks. You know, I've got a stack of notebooks. Well, they're actually in the archives of McMaster University in Ontario now. But I can get at them if I need to. But I've always had a notebook on the go. And I write down ideas as they come, and occasionally other things, little drawings or comments on this or that, or the rough draft of a speech I have to make or something like that. These things show up in the notebooks, but not an actual diary. Things will get dated, and I can identify the times and places by the events that the songs refer to as well, usually.
And speaking of documenting, there was a recent documentary named after one of your finest songs, Pacing the Cage. And am I correct?
Yeah.
And that's right. But it's not out yet for those of us here to buy on DVD.
Very close to that, but not quite. That's right.
Were you pleased with the documentary, and were you involved with the creation of it?
As the subject of it, I was intimately involved with the filming, but not really so much after that. Well, the sound mix, it's basically the tour that produced Slice of Life, the live album, live solo album that came out a few years ago. That tour was filmed and recorded. So it's become an album, and then now it's become a film. And film seems to just take a whole lot longer than music to get done. And it has partly to do with finding funding and so on, but there's more to it than that. I'm not quite sure what it all is. But it's taken this long to get the film out. It showed actually last year on Canadian TV, a slightly shorter version of it than the one that will eventually appear on DVD. The DVD version has full-length performances of the songs that appear instead of kind of abbreviated ones like the TV show had. But I was actually really happy with the way it came out. I, you know, it's a bit strange to sit there and look at yourself, especially in an audience. It's bad enough, you know, watching it on my desk, but it's been shown at a couple of film festivals, and I was at one of them in Whistler, British Columbia, and people clapped after the songs, you know, which was fun. But there I am sitting in the audience, and these people are clapping, and there I am up there, and it was weird.
Well, I look forward to seeing it because I collect a lot of music video, and there's not a lot available on you at this point for us.
No. We used to do videos for every album, like from Stealing Fire on until well into the 90s. I think the last one we probably did was Open from You, that is from You've Never Seen Everything. I think that there might have been one since then. I can't think of what it would be, though. I like the idea of doing videos, but they got kind of dumber and dumber, and we got away with a couple of good ones, one of which was actually that last one, but the whole world of video didn't live up to its original promise, in my view. It started out as a new medium where you could combine visual imagery with music in an interesting way, but it just turned into people making commercials.
Yeah, and I'm looking for the long form.
Yeah, so it's like people who are interested in live albums. I know a couple of people that only buy live albums because they feel like that's the real thing.
The real deal. We're talking with Bruce Cockburn, two shows at the One World Theater. We were just talking about a documentary on Bruce called Pacing the Cage that'll be available before too long. And I'd love for you to do another song, and I'd love for you to pick whatever you'd like to play.
Okay. How would an instrumental piece be?
Please.
Would that be acceptable?
Yes.
This is from Small Source of Comfort. This is called Bohemian Three-Step. Round of golf claps, if you please.
Very nice. Bruce Cockburn live on KUTX with Bohemian Three-Step, and that's part of his album Small Source of Comfort, one of five instrumentals on that record. which earned Bruce his 13th Juno Award for Best Roots and Traditional Album. And if you like those kind of instrumentals, I would point you to Bruce Cockburn's album Speechless, which collects his instrumentals and adds some new ones. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
So there's a few tags that get applied to you over the years, your 40-plus years of making music. One is poet, and I think that's sort of self-explanatory for people who read your lyrics, and they can decide if they agree with that. But another is activist, and that's a slippery word. Do you cotton to that word?
Not so much. I mean, I don't want to be thought of as inactive. But to me, if I think of the word activist, I think of someone who spends their time working on a cause to which they're devoted, and that whose focus is really on that, and perhaps their life is built around it. And my life is built around music and the writing of words, and often I've been able to put those words and music at the service of people who are genuine activists, who are doing what I consider to be good things in the world around various issues. But I'm not really that involved in any single issue to that degree that I would think of myself as an activist. And I don't spend time getting out there on the picket lines and stuff like that. I mean, I've done it occasionally. I've been involved in that kind of stuff, and actually drove a boat in a Greenpeace occupation at one point, dropping people off who were chaining themselves to a wood preservative facility in Western Ontario. But that was kind of a random event and a bit of happenstance. And so, you know, I mean, I guess when you come down to it, I don't like any kind of label. So if people want to call me an activist, that's as good as anything else.
But I think you told me it was in the 80s, it was through your brother that you wound up going to Central America back then, and if I remember correctly. But also you were in Afghanistan a few years ago and your brother was there.
A different brother, but yes, I have two brothers. One of them, Don, was involved in the 70s actually with solidarity work with the rebel movement in El Salvador. And he kept trying to get me interested in Central America in general, and did succeed in piquing my interest with respect to Nicaragua and in particular. And that eventually led through, I guess, circuitous route to me actually going down there on behalf of Oxfam, associated with work that they were doing. But the trip to Afghanistan, my other brother John has had a career. First as a ski coach and then as an emergency room anesthesiologist. And when at the age of 55, he decided to join the Army. The Canadian Army, which was basically holding the fort in Kandahar province in Afghanistan until the U.S. wound down the Iraq War and started moving more troops into Afghanistan. Was short of doctors, and they were recruiting, and he had come under the influence of a very impressive Canadian by the name of Romeo Dallaire, an ex-general who was, in fact, the guy in command of the UN troops in Rwanda when that horrible episode happened, and had a nervous breakdown as a result of his experiences there, and then recovered from that to become a Canadian senator and to a writer of books. And a campaigner against the use of child soldiers, and very articulate and energetic guy. And John was impressed with him, and that, I suppose, put the Army on his radar. And anyway, he ended up joining and got sent to Kandahar for a six-month tour. And I thought, you know, I've been in war zones before. I've been in Africa and Central America and Asia, but I've never been anywhere where I could actually understand the people. I've never been anywhere with Canadians, and here was my chance, I thought, you know. And so John campaigned from his end and I from mine, and we sort of badgered the Army until they finally let me go over there for a week as part of a little morale-boosting group, a kind of USO-like thing. Canada doesn't have the USO, but something similar. And it was an incredible trip. I had a good visit with John, and a number of really great experiences. I was pretty impressed with the way our folks were doing things there. I don't totally buy into the mission, although I had to respect their take on it, and it was a very well-reasoned and articulate take that, as expressed to me. But you know, I mean, even from their perspective, from the Army's perspective, they would need 30 years for the mission to succeed. That is to allow a generation of Afghanis to grow up in a state of peace. And therefore be able to build schools, et cetera, and educate kids and have the kids grow up not expecting to be carrying weapons. And the idea that that any Western government would sustain an exercise like that for 30 years just seems impossible. I can't imagine what country would do that and how they could possibly think that they could do that. But that was... You know, that was their understanding of it. I guess if I was in their position, I'd want to find a rationale for it too, because otherwise, why would I be out there risking my ass, you know, for the sake of people whose worldview is so different and so, you know, in some ways much harsher than our at least stated worldview, although many of us aren't so far off that.
But you're going as an artist, so what happens when someone who's familiar with your music at an event like that yells out for "If I Had a Rocket Launcher"?
That was the one everybody wanted to hear.
Oh.
And and the one they responded to best. And it was mostly Francophone troops, French language speakers. The regiment that was there at the time I was there, different regiments were rotate in and out, but it was a regiment called the Vendus, which is French for the 22nd. And they're historically very famous in Canada for having basically won the First World War and won World War II. But they're a bunch of young kids from Quebec who don't necessarily speak English and who don't necessarily know anything about me or my music. And even though, you know, I have maybe a bit more of a following in Quebec than most English artists, because we've made an effort to have that over the years, it's still, there's an age thing and whatnot, right? So they, you know, they're sort of probably scratching their heads, or, well, that guy plays pretty good guitar, but I don't know what the hell he's singing about, you know, until somebody would translate especially the last line of "If I Had a Rocket Launcher, Some Son of a Bitch Would Die," and then the light would go on. They'd be elbowing each other going, "Do you hear what he said? Oh man, yeah, this guy's just like us, we get it," you know, and I mean, that was kind of what came back to me, and it was interesting. I mean, I had some qualms about that. I also had some qualms about singing the line about having no use for generals in the presence of a couple of generals, you know, who were in command of the troops there. But we all got past all that stuff. And it seemed that in their context, I didn't care if they took it their way, because the song is out there. It's kind of public domain once it's out. Not literally, folks, so you still have to pay the royalties, but the in emotional terms, it's public domain, and so you know, everybody who hears it will make of it what they will. But it was, I have to say, I mean, it's really weird to think of it this way, but it was so much fun to be there for me that I sort of didn't care what I did, because I just wanted to be part of it. The tragedy was never far away, and it's that fun was had in the context of an ocean of pain that you're very aware of surrounding you all the time, and it comes close. And there's a song on A Small Source of Comfort that talks about that's an attempt to describe, to convey the feeling of what we call a ramp ceremony, where it's a ceremony held on the tarmac of the airbase, honoring the fallen. And in this case, it was two young Canadian guys who'd been killed this particular day, and their bodies were being sent home. And we happened to be there on the tarmac when it was going to happen, so they made us part of the ceremony, and we lined up with everybody else and saluted. And it was a very, very moving and poignant experience. So, you know, that became a song, but on the other side of the coin was riding out to some of the forward operating bases in a helicopter 75 feet off the ground, looking out past the door gunner at the desert, like as they do these moves to avoid ground fire, these sort of sweeping carnival moves in a way. It was very exciting. So,
well, it's fascinating. You write these songs, you send them into the world, and then they have this life of their own, and they seem to resonate in different ways as time goes on. We're talking with Bruce Cockburn, two shows at the One World Theater, and perhaps one more song before you go.
Yeah. Let me just retune here for a second. This is an older song. I think this is on an album called The Charity of Night, which is the one before Breakfast in New Orleans, Dinner in Timbuktu. I think that's right. This is called Strange Waters. And it might, well, it's not a very cheery note to end on, but it's kind of appropriate to what we've just been talking about.
Kissed by holy wind, seen a mirror pool cut by golden fins, seen alleys where they hide the truth of city. The man whose blessing you must accept without pity. I've stood in airports, guarded glass and chrome. Life. my grip. Will I take flight?
Song called Strange Waters. Bruce Cockburn live from Studio 1A on KUTX 98.9. Two shows coming up at the One World Theater. Thank you so much for making the time for us today.
Oh, thanks for having me here.
Good to see you again.
And you. Great to see you again.
That was tremendous. Congratulations on the new family and the new home in San Francisco.
Thank you very much.
And looking forward to the show.
Me too. Thanks.
Bruce Cockburn on KUTX 98.9.